Compassion Plans, Episode 17, Collaboration Saves the Day, with Lucas Chaffee from KikoChat.
The world we live in is far from perfect. How can I effectively make a difference? This is Compassion Plans, a weekly interview to help you make the world a better place with your host, Bentley Davis.
Welcome to Compassion Plans. I'm Bentley Davis, and today I have Lucas Chaffee from KikoChat. Welcome to the show, Lucas.
Hey, Bentley. Thanks for having me.
I like to start off talking about compassion, which is usually about reducing someone else's pain. So, Lucas, what pain are you trying to reduce?
So I find this question very interesting because it's coming at startups from a new angle. And I'm a software developer working in the space of online collaboration. And there's a trend these days about what's called the lean startup, where you focus on your customer's pain and helping to reduce that. And so you're speaking the same language as many other people, but what I like is you're coming at it from a different angle. In the lean startup world, they talk about solving someone's pain so that you can help them and you can make money. But you're coming at it from an angle of it's a deeper need for the entrepreneur or the social entrepreneur to be compassionate and through their works, through their acts, help other people. And so I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking, would I describe this as a compassionate project that I'm doing? And to some degree it is, but I think the focus is much more on staying in the game and creating a startup where I can do this for a living, something that I'm really excited about that is helping other people. Some of your other callers have talked about solving for pain that people don't know they have. And I think that my startup falls in that category. So when you're trying to help other people collaborate better online, they don't always know what is possible. They don't know what tools are out there. And often it's very overwhelming. So as I'm creating a few new tools to go into the group collaboration space, people don't know what is possible. So they don't actually know the pain they have. And as a developer of one of these tools, I can see better ways to do things. And so I see that people will have an easier time. But people right now, they're just accepting the difficulty of online collaboration when they don't know that it can be better. And if they knew it could be better, then they would actually see their pain. And if they saw their pain, they'd be looking more for a solution, and it would make my startup a lot easier.
Yeah, that's been a real challenge with several of the people I've interviewed and with my own projects, is that we know the pain exists, and I think people know it's there, but they've given up on it. They've given up debating with people because nowadays you post something political on Facebook and you get attacked. They kind of know they have a problem, but they don't know where the solution is or that there is a solution. And that's really the biggest thing. And so I can see that we've both and several other people have been butting up against that issue.
I like to pick up on that too. I think that when people find difficulty, they take the path of least resistance, which is often to just not bother doing whatever it was that was somewhat painful, such as posting something on Facebook. So they don't do it. And as a result, there's some, they get rid of the symptoms, which are the bad comments that come back, but the underlying pain is still unresolved. And that underlying pain is that we find it very difficult to have productive conversations with people that we disagree with, whether it's online or in person. And so we don't flesh out those disagreements. And when you aggregate that as a society, we have a lot of strong disagreement that's not on its way towards being resolved. And that will materialize as policy decisions, which are made very abruptly and made in an aggressive way against one side rather than bringing everyone to the table. So I like what you said there. People will avoid the pain, but it doesn't make it go away. It just makes it fester.
Yeah, it really grows over time. And if you think about the cost of just how much that if even just our Congress or our government officials could communicate it at a much more efficient way, how much money we would be saving our society in total just in that, not even to mention the fact that they would probably be making better decisions, because we know that diversity of opinion brings higher quality results the overall cost of this issue is just mind-boggling when you really think about it, both directly and indirectly.
And I got started in this space trying to solve that problem directly, making deliberation tools. Specifically, it was called deepdebate.org, which now points to one of the current projects that I'm working on at Athena Bridge. And with Deep Debate, the goal was to have deeper deliberation. And my personal journey was, well, I found it really painful to bring a debate or deliberation tool to institutions. I moved to DC, found it a very exciting place, lived there for 5 years, and really enjoyed it. However, there are not a lot of organizations that are working to solve the problems that they have with deliberation. And so the current project that I'm working on is much more of helping people collaborate rather than deliberate through differences. And I find that I'm able to use a lot of the skills that I learned in making software for deliberation in the collaboration space, but I still have this hankering for helping at the institutional level resolve differences on a large scale. And I know that I'm not able to work on that actively. You know, the pain that I see, which is that we can't come to consensus on very important decisions to take action. But I know that if I keep my finger on the pulse of that industry and continue to look for opportunities to make a difference with deliberation, continue to stay educated on what the cutting edge of the field is, I can get another at bat, to use a baseball analogy. I can get in there and take another swing again. But it just requires taking a very long-term approach about building your skills, looking for opportunities, networking, looking for partners, and continuing to work on finding ways that people can be collaborative. And I think that's a lower barrier than helping people who are disagreements. People are looking to collaborate. I think there's a lot more potential that they can come together and do something collaborative. Whereas people that are having differences that are not interested in deliberating, it's going to be a harder barrier. So I'm working in the collaboration space now and just testing how to get people to work together and then hoping I can take another crack at deliberation where differences are more stark.
So what got you started thinking on this issue? Because it sounds more like a passion, not something you fell into.
Yes. So my first career was as an infantry officer in the United States Army. I went to U.S. Military Academy at West Point and did a lot of exciting and fun stuff in the military. I really enjoyed that. It was 9 years of my life, 5 years active and 4 in college at West Point. And when I got out, after spending 1 year in Baghdad deployed, came back to a debate that was very fractured in the United States. And the debate just wasn't doing justice to the underlying issues of we're involved in a very serious conflict. There are a lot of stakeholders, the Iraqi people, the American taxpayer, the American soldier, sailor, marine, etc. And the debate that we were having just was not doing them justice. These issues were too serious and they weren't giving the right level of attention. And so I looked, how can I create a tool that can sort out some of these differences, not make us all sit around a circle and hold hands and love each other, but just do something a little less intimidating, which is how can we at least listen to each other and understand what the other is saying? I think there's a big listening problem that we're a little too busy disagreeing with someone else or something that we're reading that we don't actually listen to what they're saying. So built some software for that at deepdebate.org. And it was a long journey. Had to build it a few times to get it right. Software field was evolving rapidly in 2006, and it was much more expensive. Spent a lot of money, a lot of savings in getting a startup off the ground. Fortunately, in 2014, it's much cheaper with hosting in the cloud. It's much less expensive to get an initiative started. And then through that journey, through the last 8 years, I just became a software developer. And that would be the best way for me to save money is to learn how to use these tools myself rather than making money doing in another job and paying a software developer. It just also makes it a lot simpler. So looking at it from a very long-term perspective, retooling myself as a software developer allows me to get a little closer to the problem and to work on it directly. And it's still an ongoing journey. I still see many years ahead.
So you started with Deep Debate. You said made it a couple times. Did you change the name a couple times, or Have you tried several different, completely different projects?
The fundamental software had been rebuilt, let's see, I think about twice or maybe three times. It's hard to keep track. The project I'm doing now was started from scratch, but the Deep Debate project did change names. I found that people were not very interested in the word debate, because when they think of the word debate, it's having a really painful discussion with, say, a significant other or someone at work that they don't like. So the connotations of the word debate had some baggage. I came from a very fun and engaging community in high school and college. It was competitive debate. So yeah. I was on the debate team there and really enjoyed it. People got really into policy. These are policy decisions. You know, what should the U.S. foreign policy towards China be? Or what should we do for healthcare in the United States? And enjoyed that for 8 years. And I took some of the techniques that we used in competitive debate to keep track of all the arguments. It's called flowing in debate, where the people are speaking so fast on the other side, you have to keep track in a very organized way. And you've got four speakers, so you're keeping track of what everyone is saying. And so the first thing I did with the software is I said, how can I take that debate mentality and that debate method of keeping track of all these ideas and make it multiplayer, make it 10, 20, 1,000 people keeping track of ideas in a single conversation. And so built software like that starting in 2006 and continued to rebuild it. Tech was moving so fast that we would build it from scratch. Like I said before, I think it was two or three times in total, starting from scratch.
When you were doing the first couple versions, were you hiring developers to do that, or were you learning that far back?
Yes. So when I started 8 years ago, I was getting out of the military and starting a different small business at that time. Something was about making digital signs and banners and vehicle markings. Primary customer I was hoping for would be the U.S. military. Eventually, that turned into just a regular commercial sign shop, and learned a lot about how to be an entrepreneur. It was a fun business education on the ground, on the street, working with other entrepreneurs and helping them get their businesses up by providing signage for them. So something I never thought I'd do, but I fell into that one. And I sold that company to move to DC to do the debate one full time. Yes. So the code, well, I got a co-founder, a technical co-founder. I was the guy who had the debate experience. I found a software developer, and together we were 50-50 partners, and we built the first version together. When I moved to DC, I wanted to take this company to the next level, Deep Debate. And so I asked that my co-founder if I could buy his half. I bought his half, moved it to DC, and found another software developer and continued building it there with the improved version. And so it just took years and years to continue refining. Every time we got to the summit of a mountain that we thought, hey, that's where we need to be. If only the code will do this, or if only we can get another group like that to use the software, then other groups are going to see it. It was always this journey of going up this peak where you would get to a peak, but it would be a false peak. It would be the top of what you could see. So you get there. And once you get there on that little summit, you could see another summit. And then it's just another journey. I'm glad that it's like that, because it would have been too intimidating to see how far I would have had to go from the very beginning. But that incremental approach where you can only see so far and you just get to those summits, I'm thankful for that journey. I'm thankful for the challenges. I've grown a lot through it, but it has been really painful.
Yeah, I've heard from several entrepreneurs that, yeah, if they knew what it would take before they started, they would have never started. But now that they started, they want to keep going. At one point, you were giving away, you had free critical thinking software for grades 5 through 12. Did you get much uptake on that? Or was it hard even to give it away?
That's the paradox. Just to think aloud a little bit about when you have something and you want to get some traction with it, there are several strategies. You can sell it for a cheap price. You could sell it for a high price. You could give it away. And there's a whole bunch of other combinations and permutations. But I've tried each of them with that critical thinking software. And I found really surprising no's and no thank yous along the way. So even with the critical thinking software, I did get some traction. I got a few teachers from across the country that read some posts I made on different social networks for teachers. It says, here's some free software for critical thinking, for deliberation in the classroom. And people pick that up, especially now because critical thinking is becoming more of the common core standards that are being adopted across many states. And so, yeah, some folks had used it. But I think that people approach the same piece of technology differently whether it's coming from a small group or if it's coming from Google. If it's coming from Google, they're much like more likely to be a little more patient with it because they see the brand and they trust it. But if it's coming from a smaller technology company, if there's a tiny little bug or the user interface is not as simple as it needs to be, then they're going to be a lot less patient. And so I think I faced a lot of those challenges in that as a small startup, you're generally unknown. And so people have a little less tolerance for your mistakes. I think that you have to manage your customers well, and you have to tell them what stage you're at. You have to tell them what you're doing so they have confidence that anything they find can be fixed. But it's definitely a continual communication challenge, and managing their expectations is very important.
So what all have you tried in this space? So we have DeepDebate, you have AthenaBridge, which is that software itself or just a blog?
So DeepDebate and AthenaBridge are the same company. AthenaBridge has a few additional tools that we learned are necessary as more of a complete suite. Deliberation alone wasn't enough. And when we brought AthenaBridge into the classroom for critical thinking on different social issues, we found some very creative uses. And one use that we really enjoyed helping teachers implement was at the same time, students were online and they were in class, in person with each other. And you can switch between having everyone go online for 15 minutes of typing out their answers to speaking in class for 15 minutes and then go back online for 10 minutes and then back in person for 10 minutes. So bouncing back and forth between online and in person allows a much higher bandwidth of participation. People can get all their ideas out, and that's a lot more exciting for students rather than listening to just one person speak at any given time in the classroom. That's a model that we found to be really exciting. And that's what we started working with AthenaBridge as the tool grew from more than just deliberation into brainstorming, summarization, and voting.
Yeah, that's neat because it also would help with children getting bored because you'd be changing tactics.
Absolutely.
But you'd still have that interaction time of people talking directly. But the more you also have kind of a structured time when they're working together online. So that sounds like a really great way to increase learning.
I agree.
So your most recent one, Kiko Chat, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So whereas deliberation is for helping groups that are at some important disagreements, I came to Kiko Chat from starting from scratch, starting just a new company and seeing whether AthenaBridge or Kiko Chat would draw my attention more. And it's definitely Kiko Chat. AthenaBridge is currently on the back burner. And so with Kiko Chat, you find groups where you have people that have similar jobs or similar interests, and they have a general collaborative ethos. They want to help each other. And you allow them to communicate with each other in a more effective way, because then that energy of compassion or that energy of group identity will come through as long as they have good methods to communicate. So I focused on creating a few different ways for people to communicate. So all of these tools that I'm building for Kiko Chat fall under that category of collaborative groups that want to communicate better in a more structured way. Very briefly, those three tools are, first, there's a phone hotline. So creating a website where people can actually talk to each other over the phone. It's been an interesting mix of two different media, and I think there's a lot of potential there. So it's a community-powered hotline where you can reach someone to just brainstorm with someone else that shares your interest. There's a little bit of compassion there. Someone might go on the hotline and say, I want to make myself available. I don't know who's going to call me, but I know they're going to be in my field. I'm going to meet somebody interesting, and I'm going to help them for just 10 minutes and give them some ideas and let them bounce some questions off me. Just make myself available. Even though I'm doing some other work, I am interruptible, and someone can call me. The second tool is for just deeper conversations. It comes out of some things I learned out of AthenaBridge, but coming at it from a very different angle, which is collaborative conversations rather than conversations where people are different sides. And it just helps people diagram out their questions and their answers. And if you think of a conversation as having many different trains of thought, or another metaphor would be branches, the many branches of a conversation. I wanted to make sure that in the technology I build, that no one branch of the conversation is going to interrupt another branch. And you find that that happens often in blog comments and forum software where people throw in a most recent comment, and that diverts attention from some very valid, open issue that's still unanswered. And so by allowing all the branches to grow at the same time, people spend their time and attention in the places where they want to be spending, not just focusing on what comes in chronologically most recently. Briefly, the third tool is a knowledge repository, just brief questions and answers, kind of the juice or the nectar out of all of these other conversations. What can you harvest? What great ideas? Because you're going to be speaking on the phone, or you're going to be in an online conversation, and you just go on and on and on. But there was that one gem that came in like 3 minutes into your conversation. You need a place to put that so that it's easily accessible and shareable, and other people can build on that. So kind of allowing people to take any of these gems and put them in a repository where others can find them and others can build on them. Those are the three tools: hotline, conversations, and knowledge repository.
Excellent. Yeah, that sounds like a great combination. How's the uptake been so far, or how long have you... You haven't had it that long, I don't think.
So at the beginning of this year is when I started making a push to see what the uptake would be on the knowledge repository. I realized that there wasn't enough. People were still saying, well, I don't need just the knowledge repository. I still need people to be able to communicate. So that's where I started building the hotline and the conversations at the beginning of this year. So it's been about 9 months of development and testing since I realized that the knowledge repository alone was not going to be enough. I had been working on the knowledge repository for, say, 18 months before that, and doing it as the term is a hybrid entrepreneur, where you're earning some income as a consultant or you've got another job. And so as a Ruby on Rails software developer, I had a few clients, and I made sure to keep them happy so I can keep that steady part-time income stream. And that just gives me a long runway to stay in the game. And the advantage is that it takes a long time to launch a product. It's, you count from the beginning, it's over 2 years. And now I've been in the game long enough with this one tool that I realize a lot of the places that fall short, and I had an opportunity to plug those gaps by creating complementary tools to the knowledge repository. So we'll see. I'm right now at the beginning of another phase of outreach and testing. And I think that it's easier to explain a tool like a phone hotline than a knowledge repository. So I definitely see traction there in the messaging. And I'm also getting a little more help this time, reaching out to a graphic designer that's a good friend. And people expect that whatever you're building online has to look a certain way. So I just tried to put that look on there. Even though presentation is not so important to me, I realized you've got to meet the customer where they are. And if they want to see, quote, a beautiful website, you've got to give it to them. Otherwise, they're going to just be moving on to the next website very quickly.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. That's kind of the burden, but also a benefit that we have much kind of better technology and higher expectations, but it does kind of set the bar when starting a new app. You know, I find even when I'm talking about functionality with clients or with other people, if you have any sort of interface that you're showing them, they'll be swayed by the design of that interface as opposed to the functionality. So you either have to go ahead and have it designed well, or you have to use a tool that makes it look like a sketch. So people, it's a visual cue saying, don't talk to me about colors or about maybe even usability, but just the core functionality or tools that you need. So yeah, it's been challenging the last couple of years since the expectation of visual design has significantly increased.
Definitely. And I don't have advice for people about what they should do first. My technique is I've focused on building what I could do, which is the server and the front end, but it wasn't beautiful. I was just trying to make it functional and focusing on the functionality and then coming in with a designer at the end. That certainly hasn't brought me fast success, but it has been achievable. And achievable is very important. And it didn't cost a lot of money to do what I could do myself and then stay in the game long enough to realize that people needed more. And so by the time I realized that people needed more, I hadn't hired the graphic designer just yet. And then I had time to bring them on in the end to help with the most important parts that need to have attention first.
This isn't to the point towards supporting you yet, so you're still going to have to keep contracting?
That's right. For the foreseeable future, I really look forward to making the switch to doing this full time, but I just have to be patient. I know that there's a common saying of whatever you want to do is going to take twice as long and cost twice as much. And so I just am approaching this with much more of a marathon mentality so that I won't be disappointed. And managing your own expectations is very important. So you stay in the game, so you stay in the race and you don't drop out, because the more times you can overcome like a hill in a marathon, then it's easier to get over the next hill because you know you've done it before. So I think, you know, going back into getting a regular job, you know, it's a tough economy, but those jobs are generally there at the same rate as they were a year ago. So if you can sustain yourself on the outside of the regular economy, doing something you're passionate about, try to do it for as long as you can. As long as you can bear the opportunity cost, you will get better and better at it, and more opportunities will come by. And the longer you're in that space, the easier it is for you to adapt whatever you're doing to fit an opportunity that comes up. As long as you stay open-minded, and as a single operator, it's very important for me to stay connected to other people. Even though I don't have a co-founder, next time I do a startup, I definitely will have a co-founder. For whatever reason, this one, it just didn't get a co-founder. I just kept doing stuff and I realized, well, I'm a little too far right now to get a 50-50 co-founder. Oh, yeah, just keep going a little further. And it just seems like there's this carrot right in front of you. Keep going, keep going, keep going. And before you realize it, you've built something that's impressive. It took a really long time. And I think right now I need to test and see, is it something useful? Is it something valuable? Then I will be able to get another partner or co-founder at that stage. But staying in the game as long as possible is what I would recommend for new opportunities that come along.
Yeah, and maybe it's just in the last year or so, but there's been a lot of talk in the startup community about validating your ideas before you build it. And I guess that probably wasn't too popular when you started this. Did you do any validation before you started coding? Or
at least for the hotline, I did. So I asked people to sign up for it before I had built it. I found some open source code that needed some substantial changes to work as a community hotline, but I saw that it's possible. And this open source project proved that it was possible, and it just had to be customized. So I just wanted to gauge the interest in a hotline before I built it. And so that was the first time I really did that sort of validation. I just put up a simple Google form. I blasted out to the NCDD. That's the National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation. And I said, hey, if anyone's interested in testing out this hotline, please sign up on this Google form. So the whole test, you know, took me 15 minutes. And then when I saw that, hey, 20 people signed up in 2 days, I think that there's something here. Then I spent some time building it and brought those people in as the first beta testers. So validating an idea before, I think I'm doing that much more now, but definitely could have done a better job at that. And I'll say I'm not even validating it the way that they would say in the lean startup world, because you're supposed to actually see if people are going to pay, not just use it. So I'm not validating actually that people want to pay for what I'm building. Right now I'm validating that people find it useful. And I think that's a lower bar, but maybe that is just going to get me down the road further on a road that I shouldn't be going. So there's definitely something to validation. I don't do it all the time. I don't do it the way that they're saying you should do it, but I am still driving forward, mainly because I'm not in pain, because I've got that consulting gig. So I have a bit of a runway. And if I was being tougher on myself, I think I would validate more. So I think it depends on your life situation. You know, maybe if I was validating more, this whole project would be more successful. It's hard to tell, but I've definitely been able to stay in the game a long time and been able to keep adapting. I think it just comes down to what your personality type is. If you want to succeed quickly, then validation is going to tell you very quickly whether you're on a path that is a dead end. And if you want to stay in the game and learn, and you don't need to succeed overnight, then I think learning as much as possible. So just learning not whether people will buy your product or whether they'll donate money for it, but whether they'll use it, whether they'll find it fun and engaging is something definitely worth learning, because regardless, you're going to be able to use that knowledge in whatever you build next.
Yeah, and how are you doing on dividing your time between the contract work and Kiko Chat?
Yeah, so I will set aside time so I can do a full day on the contracting, because anytime you're working on software, and I imagine it's very similar for other things, it's really good to get deep into it, because then you can hold a lot more in your head and you can move faster. If you do an hour every day, you're not going to be as productive as doing several hours together. So definitely setting aside time is what I would recommend. I have different clients. So one I can do that for. Another one is a little less predictable, and they'll send me an email and it's something that needs to be done in about 36, 48 hours. So some of it's a little bit reactive and a little bit out of my control. But I'm very thankful for having these clients because they've stayed with me for a long time. So it's very important to keep them happy. I think that looking back over these last 8 years of two companies, I did go back in the workforce for 6 months, and I just felt like I would enjoy working full-time for myself more. So I left as a government consultant in Washington, D.C. And I say that financial stress is the most important thing to get under control, because that can affect everything else. In the last 8 years, I got married and now expecting a child. So financial pressure can be very difficult if you don't have ways to just mitigate it. Planning for the future, saving, and realizing that it is going to take twice as long as you expected, if you're lucky. So preparing yourself for a long haul will keep you mentally sound, and your partner will be there with you if you adjust their expectations so they know it's going to take a while. And if you've got those things, financial stress and emotional stress, under control, then you can focus on doing your best at whatever you're passionate about. But I would definitely say that I did not expect it to take so long with Athena Bridge. And so I ran out of runway, but I kept going. So it's kind of like driving a plane through the woods where there's no runway. It's not a pleasurable feeling, but I kept going because I figured I really want to get this plane off the ground, even if you got to drive it through the forest.
I don't know if you've already kind of discussed this with your wife, or how you kind of manage how much time you spend on the product side. But we set a kind of a financial goal and expectation. So with me and my wife, so that as long as I'm making a certain level of income, any additional time I have can be spent on the product. And if the product starts making money, then I can reduce my contracting. Is that part of what you have? And also, I assume a savings also to make sure that you can weather the client's ups and downs.
Yes, I think clear communication with partner is very important to ensure that you stay on the path. And although we haven't set specific numbers, having known her for many years, I know that there's a few things I need to do as a good partner for her. Is number one, I need to be present when she's present. I can't be on the computer during dinner, for example, because that's going to detract from our time together. So I've learned since we got married 2 years ago to be much more present. And that's been very useful. And also helping with our communication, because she knows that she can see my commitment to our relationship. So by showing that commitment, by saving, here's Saturday and Sunday, and I'm not going to do any work on Saturday and Sunday this weekend. Although some weekends I will do some work, just setting her expectations so that she knows I'll be there with her when we're doing activities, and I'll plan for things, do special things. I can't overstate how important it is to be there for that person, be present with them. In terms of financial numbers, I think we don't have a specific number that this needs to bring in every month. I think I just turn on the contracting dial higher when I just sense that there needs to be more security financially. And it's worked okay. Rather than having hard and fixed numbers, I just stay attuned to all these needs that we have now for buying things for an infant, for example. That requires more money. So taking on additional work to accommodate that.
So you've found co-founders in the past. Do you have any tips on finding other people to collaborate in your projects?
I'm not an expert at that, but I think there are probably a bunch of models, and I know there's people that really study this, and there's some websites where you can find co-founders. And No, I don't have any model that works right now, but I do have a lot of friends that I would consider being a co-founder with in the future. I think there's different types of startups. So one startup that you might start would be, I'm starting this so I can make a bunch of money and establish my financial security. Another type of startup would be, I've got some financial security and I want to make a huge difference in the world, and money is not the most important thing. And when you can, I think that's the really exciting type of startup, where you really just want to focus on the difference. And if you can find other co-founders that are in the same life situation where they're not desperate for cash, so there's a little less of that stress and pressure to turn a profit immediately, then you can focus on building the best product, making the most change. So different people, and even the same people in different times of their lives, will be good matches. So just thinking, like, when you're dating someone, and I think finding a co-founder is very much like getting married, except, you know, co-founders are not going to last a lifetime. So you want to find someone that's going to grow with you, and someone who's at the right life stage to fulfill the role that they're going to fulfill on your team. Not everyone needs to be at the same life stage as you. When I say life stage, I mean someone who's looking for money or someone who's looking to make a difference. Someone who's moving very quickly and wants to devote 100% of their time to their effort, or someone who's got many different efforts going and they want to spend 50% on this, 30% on that, 20% on that. So finding the right match in terms of life situation is very important. And talking about expectations and performance at the beginning, and even putting it in a contract, is really important. I'll say one more thing for co-founders too. You also want a way, when you start, you want to talk about how it's going to end also, or under what circumstances. You know, if someone wants to move to another part of the country, you should talk about that at the beginning of your initiative. Even if they don't want to move to another part of the country at that time, you should plan for those things, because maybe they find someone else that they want to move across the country for, or maybe their family grows, or maybe their family shrinks, or all these different situations where people can spend different levels of time with you in the initiative that you're building together. You should think about that so that when those things inevitably happen, you've already laid out your expectations, and there's courses of action where you can adjust the equity split, for example, if someone's going to step back or step forward. All these things are very important.
Well, that's excellent advice. What are two things we can do to help you in your effort?
If someone is part of a group that they want to see more collaboration and more communication among their group, typically a professional group is what Kiko Chat is for. You're welcome to browse the videos on the homepage. That's at kikochat.com, kikochat.com. And there's a few videos there of the tools that we've built. And please reach us if you're interested in testing out any of these tools. Happy to cut you a good deal. If you're coming through compassion plans, just let me know and I'll set you up for success. Well, that's just the only one I have. You asked for two, and I think one is good. So if you find a need for that product, then please do reach out to me. I'm learning how different groups can use this, and also focusing primarily on alumni association and trade associations, meaning pretty much any LinkedIn group, I think, is somewhat like a small trade association, a very, very small trade association. So any LinkedIn group that you want to see better communication, I'd be happy to help you.
Awesome. And what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Lucas@kikochat.com. That's LUCAS at Kiko, QIQO, chat.com.
Well, Lucas, I really appreciate you sharing your time and your experience with us and your compassion.
Thank you, Bentley. And thanks for hosting. Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for listening. Get the links and notes for today's show at compassionplans.com/17. Never miss an episode by entering your email into our subscription list while you're there. If you appreciate what we're doing, go to compassionplans.com/appreciate to find out how you can spread compassion, like rating and reviewing this podcast on iTunes. Thank you so much for caring.
I would have wanted to make it more of a conversation and talk about your answers to these same questions too, but I couldn't do that because your questions were digging so deep into my mind that I couldn't actually focus on you because your questions were so challenging. Like, I really want to answer this authentically,